This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org if you're not there already. Today, I'm pleased to have in the studio with me Tom Hayden, the 60s radical who's kept at it now for five decades more. He served 18 years in the California legislature. He writes for The Nation magazine. He's the founder and director of the Peace and Justice Resource Center out in California these days. And his latest book is The Long 60s, from 1960 to Barack Obama. Tom Hayden, it's great finally to have you here in the studio. Welcome to Progressive
Radio.
Great
to be with you, Matt. I appreciate your work.
Oh, you're too kind. I appreciate yours. I'm interested in your background a little bit. I've read a lot about you and by you, but tell me how you got politicized early on, because I read that your father was a fan of Joe McCarthy.
Not exactly. My parents came from Wisconsin, from Oconomowoc in Milwaukee, and I've got 50 or 60, 70 cousins around the state. And I was raised here in the summertime. I went to the University of Michigan for my degree. I was the editor of the paper there. I knew the Daily Cardinal editors, and I think I was impacted by the black students from the South and some of the whites who I encountered when I was a young man, 20 years old, 19 years old. And it was not so much the civil rights issue, although that I was introduced to the legal issues. It was the appearance in my generation of young people willing to risk their careers and their lives for what they believed. And this was just what I needed in terms of modeling. And so from there, everything followed.
And parental influences, were parents were political or not?
No. I mean, the lefties have always inspected me, trying to figure out where I came from. They thought I was a prize because I had no political background. There was no left-wing blood in my family line, as far as they could tell. I do think that the experience of Irish Catholic immigrants who came to Sullivan and to parts of Wisconsin and are still buried here, the Garrities, probably had a influence, but it's hard to have access to your ancestors. What I do know is they fled the British famine, and my name, Thomas Emmett Hayden, is, of course, derivative of Thomas Emmett, who created the Irish-American nationalist and revolutionary immigrant movement in New York. And when I asked my mom at one point why I was Thomas Emmett Hayden, the fourth, I guess, she said, because there was Thomas Emmett Hayden the first, second, and third. So I guess the immigrant experience was erased, ethnic cleansing, otherwise known as assimilation into American society. But it's there. I mean, it's like a black kid being named Malcolm X Hayden and asking their parents, why'd you call me Malcolm X Hayden? And the parents said, well, no, I don't really know. So there's some hidden impact, but it certainly was not political. My dad was a Republican. My mom was a Adlai Stevenson Democrat.
And how did they...
But neither of them were active in anything.
My parents were Adlai Stevenson Democrats, too. That's interesting. How did they react to your increasing visibility and radical politics?
Neither understood it. My mom kind of was supportive, but she couldn't tell Indochina from Indonesia. And my dad disowned me, said he didn't know where the foreign influences had crept in.
Really?
And he started a whole new family and didn't tell his second child that she had a brother, that is me, till she was about 16 years old under family pressure. So we reconciled. He turned against Nixon. We became very close at the end.
Oh, that's nice. I lost my dad recently, and I always was on good terms with him, so we didn't need to reconcile. But
good.
For sons who don't reconcile with their fathers, and for fathers who don't reconcile with their sons, I just can't quite...
It's a curse.
Can't quite get it. I'm speaking with Tom Hayden. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Looking back on the 60s, Tom, what would you say the biggest accomplishment was?
Well, we didn't say, hey, we're creating the 60s any more than people in Wisconsin this year said we're creating the Wisconsin movement. The accomplishments were greater than most people realize and many historians prefer to forget. The enfranchisement of millions and millions of people, 27 million by my count, blacks in the South and 18-year-olds, the environmental movement with 20 million people on Earth Day at the end of the 60s, the overthrow of two presidents by demonstrations and public disaffection, the rise of the women's liberation movement. The central thread, I think, was the emergence of a whole new class of young people, mainly students, who were we empowered ourselves as a factor to be dealt with more than any previous generation of young people. And it required a new analysis in which students and middle-class people had to be included in the concept of positive social change along with blacks and Latinos and immigrants and working-class people. I think we changed the definition of who's included in the American radical movement or progressive movement by opening a path for middle class.
And what do you make of some criticism of the 60s student movement as being clashing with working class or trade union movement?
Well, some of that was manufactured. It was one of the dirty tricks that Nixon employed to get some of the hard hats against the hippies and so on. Some of it was genuine. There was a social and class difference between people who felt they should sign up and go to Vietnam and people that took an exemption. If I was being abstract, I would say the law of uneven development was at work, mm-hmm. but I don't want to be abstract. What's new and pretty fantastic about what's happened here in Wisconsin is the way that the Republican reaction to the gains of the 60s and the 30s through the governor's actions brought together the police, the firefighters, the traditional trade unions, along with the women and the youth and the students, in a solidarity across many lines that we haven't seen before. It's the most promising thing, I think, that's happened in America since the election of Obama.
It was really an ecstatic period here in
ecstatic
Wisconsin.
Ecstatic is a perfect choice of words.
And Howard Zinn called it in his writings, he talks about the flash of the possible, and here we were experiencing the flash of the possible.
More than a flash. It's a holy experience. It breaks out unexpectedly. It's based on previous generations' invisible contribution. It usually requires the inflicting of a moral injury or a grievance by an overreaching politician or business lord.
We certainly had that moral and economic grievance.
Yeah, I think you need a moral injury to your dignity combined with something specific, in this case, certain public employee rights that were well established in the Washington consensus, in the Wisconsin consensus. Right. But who could have predicted the response? It's equally possible that people will lay down and take these sort of things, especially if they're pessimistic.
I'm sure that's what Walker and the Republicans thought. People have taken so much for
so
long.
Yeah, bad guess. They'll pay for it.
It was a bad guess. But one of the most euphoric things was just what you were talking about, Tom Hayden, and that is that there was this spontaneous, though the unions were organizing behind it and other progressive groups were also, but this largely spontaneous uprising, not just of public sector workers and not just of the elite of public sector workers, professors, for instance, or middle-class students, but they're, public sector workers who were making the lowest amount or were working, jobs that I interviewed someone who'd been on the job and was just making $30,000 as a corrections officer, someone who was working in the hospital for mentally handicapped people, and she's making about the same after 10 years. They were all out there, AFSCME workers, many of them. But also there were the police and fire that you mentioned. They weren't even impacted directly by this
edict. It was fantastic.
It was incredible solidarity. And then there was the solidarity from the private sector workers. There were machinists and teamsters and carpenters and steam fitters and electrical workers. And it was just a huge cross-section of the working and middle class here that, you know, I read about in my studies of left-wing politics. But to see it come to life was extraordinary. And
it's
still here.
Yeah, no, it should be a lesson that people who write off other people have got to look at it. A genuine, authentic social movement has all of those qualities, but also the music. While I was here recently on the 141st day of the sing-along, who would have imagined rewritten labor songs being sung in the rotunda by 200 people every day?
Yeah, every day at noon, it's been great.
The sense of humor on the signage, the people writing their own slogans, and that you can detect beyond the organizations, which played an enormously important role, you can detect the inner organization of the crowd of people itself, somehow the organic desire to keep it peaceful and to adjust creatively to possible dangers. That's not the kind of thing that you can order people to do. Obviously, you can talk about it, but when this happens, you are in a blessed moment, and everyone that I've met in Wisconsin is still, they don't even notice it because it's been the new normal, but they're kind of high. They've been altered. They're in a extraordinarily positive state as a result, and this doesn't happen very often.
Right, there is a lingering giddiness, and and part of that was the spontaneity and the creativity,
yeah,
and almost the carnival-like atmosphere.
Exactly,
at the protest.
People were freezing having fun in an ice storm. It's unbelievable. Anyway, you know, this is considered to be a right-wing time. I see the Tea Party as the vanguard of a counter-movement against the 60s and the 30s. And counter-movements often are more intense because they perceive themselves to be losing status and losing position against the new consensus. And they bring on a rival movement. They awaken a reaction. And I'm not saying you need the Tea Party for this to happen, but They do go together, and so I'm not completely pessimistic about the emergence of the new Republican Party. I'm worried about the potential for violence. I'm worried about their backing by the Koch brothers and the funding. But you know, if the movements do their job and this alliance continues, we have many more people, much larger base to draw on in elections in the future, locally and nationally.
Speaking with Tom Hayden, of course, the author of the Port Huron Statement, the legendary document that kicked off the 60s. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive. The Tea Party people, you mentioned violence. You're worried about right-wing violence?
I am. Obviously, So is the White House. The Department of Homeland Security issued a report in 2009. That's not an agency that I'm friendly towards. They issued a report saying the election of a black president combined with an economic recession is leading to a rise of violent threats and violence by right-wing militia networks. There you have it. That's official diagnosis. And of course, the Rush Limbaughs, your rivals on radio, were out there bashing Homeland Security for saying this, but it's true. It's absolutely true. We don't know how easy it is to achieve a peaceful political transition in American politics. It remains to be seen. You know, all the talk about our uniqueness in the world is that we have peaceful elections. Well, one legacy of the 60s that I do not want to see repeated is how the murders of the Kennedys and King and Malcolm X basically decapitated our movement, split it, drove it off the rails, when it might have resulted in a peaceful coming to power of a broad progressive coalition, including radicals, including students, but broader than that. Without dwelling on conspiracy theories, I think it's certainly in the interest of everyone to act in ways that minimize the threat of violence against elected officials.
So, I mean, to be blunt, you're worried that Obama could be assassinated?
Well, everybody says that's what everybody's thinking, but don't talk about it. So I'm careful how I talk about it. But let's talk about Representative Giffords having her, you know, her assassination experience and living to tell the tale with a bunch of other people dead. When I read her would-be assassin's document materials on email, I didn't think this was the raving of an isolated lunatic. This was the stuff that I've read published by the Anti-Defamation League on the sovereign citizens movement that doesn't believe in the authority of anybody above the sheriff's level, that doesn't believe in paying taxes, that is linked to white supremacy movements. And I'm not saying that the Tea Party can be reduced to this, but I know from my experience as a state senator that these small groups lurk within and are harbored by the broad right-wing culture of the United States. And remember, the person that she was running against, who hasn't been heard from, he barely lost the election. He might have won, but he was one of these people. He wanted to send 10,000 American troops to the Arizona border in what he called active enforcement mode. He had fundraisers that invited people to use an AK-47 and load up against Congresswoman Giffords.
Sarah Palin had the same
stuff from Sarah Palin with her sights, and yeah. People retreat from this. But I'll tell you, I authored a resolution to California legislature some time ago against the targeting for assassination of abortion doctors, and it had some components about what the government should do, and it passed without a no vote, but it didn't pass with any Republican votes in favor, except maybe one, 25 against, or not voting. And I talked to one of my Republican colleagues, you know, why? He says, Tom, we got these people in every one of our districts, and so we're just not going to vote on this. Because he evidently thought it would inflame somebody in his constituency if he voted for a resolution, not a law, a resolution condemning violence against doctors performing abortion. So it's a menace I worry about, absolutely. Mm. But it seems inevitable. It just seems when social movements are successful, they provoke a reaction from people who perceive themselves to be losing. And if you have a governing arrangement where white males in certain categories are actually losing jobs and losing income, and they perceive, it's like being on an elevator, who's going up, who's going down. They perceive others who were below them rising above them. You're going to get real rage and resentment. So the question I have after 50 years is, why is it impossible to raise the incomes of white males along with the efforts to raise everybody? What? It's almost like a conspiracy. Let's elevate women. Let's elevate minorities. Let's elevate Latinos. Let's unionize the farm workers. All this. And somehow the richest country in the world can't raise everybody's income. That is a recipe for divide and conquer, whether it is deliberate or just the workings of our economic system. It amazes me, and I keep pointing it out, and nobody can answer why income has been stagnant for most American families since 1973.
Well, what's your answer?
I don't understand it, because it's not so simple to blame capitalism, because other capitalist societies have a bigger safety net, better income, longer vacations. It's a peculiar outcome of our particular political economy. I don't know what the answer is, but I worry about it every day.
Seems to me it's becoming more primitive capitalism in the United States.
Yes.
And that's a worry for me every day, too. You've also written about another exciting social movement. We talked about what's been happening in Wisconsin, but the immigrants' rights movement.
Well, absolutely. I live in Los Angeles, which is in a different zone of this globalized battle, and we had this amazing turnout of 1 million people on the streets just a few short years ago in Los Angeles, and I'm impressed with the immigrant movement's success not in preventing deportations. That's the bad side. But recently, the Obama administration has relaxed any threat of deportation for the undocumented undergraduate students or members of the military. That's a de facto implementation of the DREAM Act, which they couldn't get through Congress. From where I sit, as the descendant of Irish Catholic immigrants to Wisconsin, who came to this country which says no Irish need apply, I can only have sympathy for people who come from Mexico or Central America, where we've waged war and drained their economies and imposed NAFTA arrangements. I mean, most of them, not all, but the vast majority, are coming to clean our toilets in Arizona and hope for a better life as a result of NAFTA policies, which uproot rural people and leave them no option except being on the road to Los Angeles. And it's a reversible situation. I think we should end the drug war. 30,000-40,000 people have been killed on our border since we supported Calderon's policy of militarizing the drug crisis. And we should revive NAFTA, which Obama promised to do but hasn't yet.
Revise NAFTA, you mean? Right.
Did I say?
You said revive, I think.
Eliminate. Look, I mean, nobody has paid attention to this, but Pew and the New York Times have published a report saying essentially migration from Mexico has ended anyway. Has anybody read that? Why would people come here into places like Arizona during a recession when there's no jobs here anyway? It's just a politicized issue rather than an issue that requires careful negotiation fundamental policy changes.
Speaking with Tom Hayden, of course, here I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. This is Progressive Radio. You mentioned President Obama earlier in your book, The Long 60s. You're very favorably disposed toward Obama. What's your assessment?
Well, I mean, I was very moved by the election process. I've got an adopted son who's African-American. I've got a daughter-in-law who's African-American. I've got a stepdaughter who's African-American. We got the message of the civil rights movement. I live in an integrated family and household, and it was just trembling with excitement and worry all through that campaign. I come from the jails and door knocking experiences of Mississippi, where people didn't permit themselves to even dream of such an event. So I place a very high importance, even if it was his only achievement, which it won't be, but if it was his only achievement, the election of Barack Obama, Barack Hussein Obama, was a modern miracle from the point of view of social movements. At the same time, I supported Obama over the criticism of some of my African-American friends by working on a project called Progressives for Obama, in which we said we felt entitled to fundamentally disagree on certain issues. And it wasn't difficult for us to be passionate about defeating McCain, electing Obama, and also disagreeing from the start on Afghanistan, disagreeing on a number of other issues, and knowing that he was going to position himself as a centrist. And so we obviously were going to have a responsibility to pressure from the left or from the progressive side. And I've spent the last 2 years, I'm sure the White House doesn't like it, but just hammering on Afghanistan, Iraq, the long war doctrine of the Pentagon, 80 years of these conflicts, the effect on places like Wisconsin where the budget money is drying up because of the trillion-dollar wars. And the only thing I can see is by persistent pressure gradually turning him around. He has not satisfied the right or the left. But those of us who are working for practical results see that there has been a change this year with the election coming up, and the DNC, which is under his control, passed a resolution calling for rapid withdrawal. Barbara Lee got 205 votes. I mean, Jim McGovern of Massachusetts got 205 votes in the House for rapid withdrawal. Obama agreed to 33,000 troops to be withdrawn by next year, with more to be withdrawn in subsequent months. So I'm hoping for 50,000 out by the election. That will require a peace presence in the political process. You know, hopefully that money will be transferred to states like Wisconsin that need the money. If you just took the 47,000 troops out of Iraq, which were waiting on pins and needles, what is he going to do? That would mean $50 billion that could go straight to job creation in the U.S.
I'm willing to bet you he leaves most of those there if he can get the Iraqi government to agree.
He won't. It'll be between 47,000 and zero. But it's an insane policy, and he knows it. He's not in control of the whole situation. I mean, the insanity is Bush and the American government installed a pro-Shia, pro-Iran regime with torture chambers in Baghdad, and now is being asked by Saudi Arabia to leave some troops behind to counterbalance Iran in the conflict between the regional conflict between Saudis and Sunnis. If I was a soldier, and I have a close friend who's in Iraq fighting, I would not want to be pinned down in a crossfire between sectarian forces with 10,000 or 13,000 of my buddies. So that's the argument against. Save money, get the troops out, and, you know, don't go to bat for Saudi Arabia in exchange for oil, fighting against a regime that the United States installed. So the issue in Iraq isn't over. The argument remains. We shall know in a month.
You're much more optimistic.
I didn't say I'm out. I'm a fighter.
I know you are.
I'm targeting.
I see Obama in a much more critical way, especially, you know, taxes for the hugely rich, the debt limit agreement, the compromise on health care, the failure to do anything significant on houses, and the mediocre stimulus package at the beginning. So maybe he wasn't positioning himself in the center and just was in the center. But we're out of time. I wish we could run that around the bushes for another half hour.
I hope it's not. We're not going to run it around the bushes.
Or Tom Hayden.
Or the Perrys or the Palins.
Or the Michelle Bachmanns. Tom Hayden's been my guest.
One step at a time, my friend. One step at
it's
a
great
time.
Great to meet you. Great to talk with you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.